May I speak in the name of God, the lover, the beloved, and the love sharer. Amen. So continuing our journey through the Old Testament readings over these past Sundays, with today's reading, we come to the end of the book of Genesis, and Joseph remains in Egypt, and he and his father's household seeing his descendants to the third generation. As he lay dying, he requested the return of his bones to the land of Abraham, and then he died at the age of 110. Joseph had come a long way from the provocative brat prancing about in his technicolor dream coat. And Genesis concludes by telling us that Joseph was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. And with Joseph's death, the stage is now set for the next installment in the history of Israel, as recorded in the book of Exodus. And today we heard from Exodus 1:1-7, with a recap of the 12 sons of Jacob who came down to Egypt, the death of Joseph and that whole generation, and that the Israelites continued to be fruitful and prolific. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong in the land, and it was filled with them. Exodus 1:1-7 is the explanatory preamble to what we are now told in verse 8, which begins with the ominous words, "Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph." 12 momentous words that introduce us to the story of the enslavement of the Hebrews in Egypt. The new Pharaoh has come to fear and envy the presence of a people living separately within his domain. We might read this as the first historical instance of anti-Semitism proper, a hatred of Jews born of the mix of fear and envy, exacerbated by a refusal to abandon their separate identity. The Pharaoh, who had forgotten who and what Joseph had done, had come to fear the separate identity of the Hebrews, a nation within a nation separated by customs, religion, a dynamic to be repeated again and again throughout the history of the Jewish people. Pharaoh indulges in hyperbole when he says that the Hebrew people are more numerous and powerful than we are, so come, let us deal shrewdly with them. His pretext casts them as a fifth column who, in the event of war, would join the enemy. I say hyperbole because were it true that the Hebrews were more numerous and powerful than the Egyptians, why then didn't they resist enslavement? We're not privy to Pharaoh's mindset. We only know what the Deuteronomist compilers of the history say, their aim being to give the context to explain the Hebrew enslavement in Egypt. And as we read or listen to Exodus, we hear historical echoes in the Nazi use of a similar hyperbole as justification for the extermination of European Jewry. In this ancient story, as the pretext for the internment of the Pacific Coast Japanese communities in 1941, you can imagine the US government saying, "Let us deal shrewdly with them for fear that they will give aid to our enemy." We witness it in the Chinese Communist Party's Uyghur internment in vast forced labor camps. We note it in Russia's forced transportation of Ukrainians and Crimean Tatars, in all the attempts to destroy the future through the theft of the children. And so the Exodus story so far, we learn that the early phase of forced labor seems not to have dented the prolific growth in the Hebrew numbers. And growing more desperate, Egyptian policy becomes more ruthless, culminating in a policy of infanticide. The Hebrew midwives are instructed to kill the male babies at birth. However, we're told that the midwives feared God and refused to do so. When interrogated, They tell Pharaoh that the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women because they are more vigorous, giving birth before they can arrive. Now, the midwives use the word, the Hebrew word, chayot, which is more evocative than the sanitized English translation as vigorous. Chayot means brutish, animal-like. The midwives complain to Pharaoh, "What can we do? These Hebrew women breed like rabbits," thus turning Pharaoh's dehumanizing trope against him. The narrative now switches to the birth of the Hebrew male infant whose mother placed him in a waterproof basket and concealed him among the bulrushes at the river's edge, charging her daughter to watch from a distance to see what would happen. Pharaoh's daughter came down to the river to bathe, and when she and her maids heard the infant's cry, she recognized the infant as a Hebrew. The infant's older sister offered to find a Hebrew nurse to care for the child, and the princess agrees. Thus, the infant is restored to his mother, who raises him until the time when he is adopted by the princess as her own son. The princess names him Moses, because I drew him out of the water. Now, words matter, and it should not be lost on us that there are several other details in this story. For instance, the word used to describe Moses' basket is also the same word used for Noah's ark. The Deuteronomists are at pains to identify Moses as, in some sense, like Noah. They also point out to us through his parental lineage that he belongs to the line of Levi, and Moses is a member of the tribe which after the Exodus become the Levitical priesthood. But a key detail in the Exodus story concerns the role of women. The actions of the midwives, Moses' mother, sister, and Pharaoh's daughter and her maidservants express the resistance of women against patriarchal violence. The birth of Moses is a story about female fidelity to God, birth, maternal and sisterly love, and women's instinctual compassion for the vulnerable. And as it was, so it remains. The initiative sponsored and led by women ministering among the migrants on the Mexico-US border continue this long tradition of resistance to patriarchal violence because of a concern for the vulnerable. Women are often more likely to be motivated by an appreciation of human needs, seeing in the easily dehumanized migrant faces the faces of women and children and families. Restoring to the migrants the fullness of their human dignity. Now, I only have space and time to note that in the text for this sermon, there is a link identifying the role of women in six care agencies working with migrants along the southern border. But like the women in the first two chapters of Exodus, today women are at the forefront of resisting the dehumanizing process of the immigrant experience, which opens us to a wider observation. Today, the myth that promotes a fear of immigrants as having some secret power or potential to steal our jobs, incidentally, jobs we no longer deign to perform, and who pose a dangerous threat to law and order and national stability, would be ironic if it was not so tragic. In a nation chronically short of unskilled labor, to fill the job vacancies we rely on and yet reject as somehow beneath us, it's ironic and tragic that in a nation of immigrants, where a sizable portion of the population is separated from the immigrant experience only by one, two, or three generations at most, should now vehemently advocate pulling up the migration ladder behind them. Of course, the economic health of the U.S. now depends on immigration. Like the ancient Hebrews, migrant communities have higher birth rates. And instead of seeing this as some kind of race replacement conspiracy, we need to remember that like our parents and grandparents, today's migrants long to become American and to imbibe American values and as they integrate. Cultural integration is a two-way street. And immigrants bring elements that are currently revitalizing the host culture, from the arts we celebrate to the food we eat. If concern for the plight and suffering of fellow human beings is not enough to move our hearts, and clearly it's not, let's not forget that necessary immigration will ensure a healthy labor and tax pool large enough to sustain the Social Security and Medicare systems that an aging boomer population is increasingly reliant upon. I want to highlight two further elements in the Exodus narrative. Firstly, the experience of enslavement and liberation fundamentally shaped the development of the post-Exodus Israelite community. In remembering their own captivity and liberation, Israelite law enshrined a sacred duty to welcome and respect the stranger in their midst. This sacred duty, like many sacred duties more often observed in the breach, yet nevertheless became a central moral principle for the post-Exodus Israelite society. And secondly, the Exodus, as recorded in the book of the same name, marks a crucial transition in the evolution of God's identity. This is a point often lost on us. Up until this point, God is identified as creator. Now, in the enslavement and liberation of the Hebrews, God identifies God's self as liberator. The Exodus event becomes for all enslaved people a sign of the promise that God not only hears their cry and notes their suffering, but works for their liberation. This weekend, as we celebrate the memory of the historic 1963 March for Freedom, we remember the Exodus experience graphically demonstrated in our own national history as the spiritual and social catalyst in the African-American journey from the days of enslavement into the continued civil rights struggle of our own time. The liberator God is also a personal God, a God who requires human collaborative agency, be they midwives, mothers, sisters, or princesses. In the birth and life of Moses, God now finds his next principal collaborator. Because not since the days of Abraham has God encountered a human being in the intimacy of a personal relationship. And the promise to Abraham now is renewed in the promise to Moses. The God of Abraham now becomes, for all intents and purposes, the God of Moses. And it seems that the liberator God is not yet done. And next week we'll pick up the story with more about Moses. Amen.